The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
If you are passionate about food and how it supports well-being and health, learn more. The Institute for Optimum Nutrition has been training nutritional therapists for 35 years on its highly acclaimed and accredited diploma courses. Start your new career in nutritional therapy, one that will make a difference and help others achieve their health goals. Train with the home of nutritional therapy education. Find us online and give us a call or click on the IOM banner on the UK Health Radio homepage.
Recovery Today on UKHealthRadio.com. Join me and my guests on this voyage of recovery and discovery.
Hello everyone, my name is Jim Smith and welcome to Recovery Today. Okay, well today my guest is Richard Sutton. Now Richard's a very old friend, and rather than just introduce him and get him to speak now, I'm just going to let you know the story of how we re-met. We went to school together, Richard, secondary school. Richard was in the year below. This was in the 60s. This was in South Norwood. And although we knew each other, we weren't, you know, friends. I mean, when you're in a different year, you know, that's it, isn't it? It's a different dimension. However, we went our own ways. And, you know, I had a really rocky ride in life and had an addiction problem. And actually started off at a place called Pinnell House in Wallingham Park Hospital in October 1976. My consultant was Dr. J.J. Gayford. Well, unbeknown to me, when I eventually met Richard about 38 years ago, 40 years ago, he told me that he'd had a similar, you know, kind of experience in life, and he'd gone into Wallingham Park in 1975, about a year before me. Similar issues, drugs and alcohol, but they'd impacted with Richard in a slightly different way. So I think that's a good opening, really, Rich, to maybe you can explain how they did impact on you.
Yeah, okay. Well, we were together, as you said, at school, and we would have left, we wouldn't have done our A-levels or something. I think we both left quite as soon as we could, really. I went to work. I'd already got some issues because I had been taking amphetamines while I was at school, because we were all mods and we used to steal off up to London on Saturday nights, even probably when I was 15, and I had it was fine for a while, but it started to go wrong. However, I wasn't in a state that was preventing me from going to work. So I managed to get a job. I was good at art, got a job as a junior in an art studio up in the West End, and learned that trade of being I was a post-up artist, and that's what I went back to eventually when I recovered it. Yeah. In 1977 or whenever it was. So I worked at that for 5 years, and the kind of youth culture was changing from the mod thing to the hippie thing. I was kind of on the periphery of that. I wasn't really in the centre of it. I didn't quite fit into it, but my friends were all taking drugs, and I thought, I knew I had to change my life from the way it was, so I started, which is not a good motive for taking things like LSD, but that's what I did, however. And, of course, it had a good effect, but I wasn't able to cope easily with it. I suppose you would say I'm not really a candidate for all that, but I don't regret doing it, having said that, because it did actually change my life. I had some good experiences, had really nice times with some lovely, beautiful people at the time. However, it went badly wrong. I lost my job. I was out of work. I was living with students in North London. They finished their degree courses, and the house was we had to leave the house, and I had nowhere to go, and I became homeless, I was really by that time I was in a pretty bad state, and that was probably 1970, end of 72 probably. I lived on the streets in London for 4 months. I couldn't really go back to live with my parents, because I was kind of, nothing against my parents, but I was so much at odds with everything that was going on in my home, with their home life. So I lived on the streets, and eventually that was from November until the end of February. By the way, if you're ever living on the street in the winter time, you need a sleeping bag. But to keep warm, wrap yourself in newspapers and climb into the sleeping bag. Yeah. You'd be surprised how warm that is. Anyway, that's a footnote. I thought, this is crazy, because I could feel myself becoming more unwell. It wasn't addiction, it was psychosis. I was becoming very catatonic, if you like. So I decided I need to change this. I got myself arrested by going to Westminster Hospital and asking for Largactil, which I thought would help me. They wouldn't give it to me. They said, we can't give it to you because you haven't got an address. If you don't go, we'll call the police. So I thought, it's probably a good idea. Let me go through the system. They called the police. The police took me away. In Brixton for 3 weeks for psychiatric reports, and then sections back to court. The police were really nice to me, actually. They could see I was in a lot of trouble. The magistrate said, I'm not going to give you a criminal record, because the charge was breach of the peace, which was just something they needed to arrest me, grounds to arrest me. Went back to court. The magistrate said, I'll section you to Tootenbeck Psychiatric Hospital for 30 days. So in a minicab down to Tootenbeck, while I was there, first of all, I was put in a secure unit. First thing I remember was I was sitting in the reception waiting to get admitted, and then some guy came up with a chair and broke the television up with it. So I thought, I don't really want to be here, you know. So, but they said, well, you're fine. We'll put you in an ordinary unlocked ward. So they put me. I was there for 3 months. And then that would have been probably 1973, probably. And then it went on really in and out of hospital until last time I came out of hospital was 1976, probably, where I managed to, in between times I received ECTs at Tootenbeck and then again at Warning Park Hospital. I remember Tootenbeck, I really didn't want the ECTs. And what we used to do, we used to sneak out in the morning, go to the off-license, buy a bottle of wine, drink half a bottle of wine, and then they couldn't shock you, you know. So, anyway, what I'm trying to say is I eventually got in such a bad way that I was ready to accept help. And in Warning Park Hospital, they again said to me, we need to give you some ECTs. So I had six ECTs, changed my life, turned me around. I mean, not because I was getting kind of psychotherapy at the same time. Weird thing, you know, they sedate you for the ECTs. When you're coming round from the sedation, they've done the ECT, they're actually talking to you and you're talking to them. I didn't know quite what I was saying, but it was very beneficial to me. And
you just mentioned, I'd like to go back a few seconds. You actually said I was ready. You seem to have reached that point that you were receptive to help.
Yeah.
And that is so key, isn't it?
Because before that, I didn't trust anyone to know anything enough about me to help me. What I was suffering from is quite a common occurrence. They've seen it before. And I was I really got to the point where I thought, I can't deal with this myself. You know, I need to get help. And that's how I became, got admitted. I had this friend, this girl, Alison, who put me on a, got me on a bus, and I went to Morning Park. And then that was a big, that was the start of a big turnaround in my life.
So would you say your recovery began at Warningham Park Hospital?
Yeah, definitely.
That's definitely right.
I mean, I had been taking things like codeine with penicillin, you know, to try and slow myself down. And I had actually got a bit strung out. So there was that sign of complication to it. It was, it did relate in some way to drugs. To taking drugs as well.
Okay, Rich, I think it's time for our first piece of music. You're a musician. Your instrument of choice is a saxophone. So it was hardly...
Tenor sax.
So it's hardly surprising that your choice is...
Well, there's lots of different music, but I thought these are all saxophone players that I've chosen today.
So the first piece of music, it's Art Pepper. Do you want to...
Yeah, it's Art Pepper. Was someone I didn't discover until years after I'd recovered, actually. But he has been through a big... He went through a lot of stuff.
He was
in San Quentin for 7 years. Yep. He had a big drug problem. But the great thing about Art Pepper, he finished on a high note. He was really on the ascent. And this is a tune by Art Pepper.
Called Miss Who?
It's called Miss Who. It's actually based on the chord sequence of Sweet Georgia Brown.
Okay, let's play it now. Art Pepper, Miss Who. Thank you. Well, that was Art Pepper. Yeah, what a great player.
Brilliant.
Great player. So, look, we're at Wallingham Park. Your recovery is beginning. So how long were you there? And then what happened when you came to leave? Where did you go?
I was there at that time for about 14 months.
Mm.
And the last stop off at Wallingham Park was in the rehab unit, Douglas yeah. House.
Right.
And I actually managed, I was feeling it so much better. I was in a much better place.
Mm.
Although, and now the task was to re-establish my life. I had to start again, really. And I managed to get a job in Clapham. I was washing dishes in a warehouse in Clapham for a catering firm. And I did that. I used to get the bus down from Wallingham to East Croydon, get on the train to Clapham, go and do that, and then come back. And I did that from the hospital for about probably 4 months, I think. And then eventually they discharged me from the hospital.
Mm.
And they got me a place to actually go and live with a family in Selhurst, which was, they took in lodgers.
Yeah.
So I was still working at the warehouse in Clapham, but I'd left the hospital.
So. Yeah. And you were, how old were you? About late 20s?
No, I was 26.
I see, yeah.
26, yeah.
Yeah. And what about your family, Richard? Were they...
Yeah. Well, I was I had to kind of establish my relationship with my parents.
Yeah.
I mean, my mother, they didn't really know what was going on, but they were always, they were good parents. You have to say these things I brought on myself, I think. Mm. It wasn't their fault.
No.
But when you're that age, generally people sometimes blame their childhood, their parents for things. But, yeah, my parents were pleased that I was recovering. And yes. They were pleased that I'd got a job.
Yeah.
And that I was moving in the right direction finally, because during that time,
yeah,
very difficult time for them, obviously, your child is very unwell, disappears for 4 months, you don't know where they are.
No.
That's not something you'd wish on any parent.
No. I often hear, you know, people talking about their parents, and they say they did the best with what they had. You know, how their parenting was, and it sounds as though your parents did the very best they could.
Yeah, they did. I mean, my father, they were exactly with what they had.
Yeah.
My father wasn't a very confident person, but, and we weren't brought up as children to be confident.
No.
We were brought up to be well-behaved, but not confident. Whereas today, it's the opposite of that, you know.
That's right. What about your music? Did you resume playing early on?
I think the big motive for me to go back to work was to get the money together to buy another saxophone.
Was it? Yeah.
Because prior to me becoming unwell and messed up, I'd been playing for about 4 years probably.
Yeah.
And I'd been playing in some soul bands, and I played in it was Freddie Mac. Freddie Mac Extravaganza. He's the offshoot of that was the International Roadshow, which I played with for a while when I was about 19, 20. So music was a big thing for me. And I then felt fit to play.
Yes.
Whereas during my illness, during those 5 years, I had actually got a saxophone.
Mm.
I just take it back to the shop because I wasn't in the right place to play. You know? Mm. So, I got a saxophone on the HP from Bill Lewington's in Shaftesbury Avenue, probably after I got back into my job, which was advertising.
Yeah.
So I had a reasonable income to get another sax.
Mm.
And then some things I'd forgotten. It took me a while to get back to playing as I wanted to be. But obviously music is a big thread that runs through my life, and it is beneficial to people.
Of course. Now, I've got to mention here that not really running alongside you, but a similar time reference really was that I was at a place called Trelawne, a halfway house, for 15 months from February 1977 No, I don't know if I met you in Croydon in that year, but it was either 77 or 80, or it was early on for me when I met you. And we didn't have coffees in those days, did we? We probably went for a cup of tea somewhere, you know. But you asked me if I was still playing, and I said, yeah, I played at the hostel. And then you told me about Ruskin House, the local folk club. Yeah. And, you know, you kind of encouraged me to go down there, yeah, which I did. You played harmonica.
Yeah, you did get back into your playing.
Yeah, I did.
Probably you'd been taken up with family life before. You had three young daughters. It was difficult.
Well, no, this was long before that.
Okay.
Oh, this was 1977. Oh, you know, yeah. Okay. No, this was when I, you know, was beginning my recovery.
Right.
And I was very aware, you know, I thought I can't play in public. Not, you know, I had done in the past when I was drunk or under the influence of drugs. And of course, I just fell down. I never played any decent music ever, really. But, you know, this was like a new beginning, and you encouraged me to go to this folk club. And I think we did a few blues songs there one night. And that was the beginning of my music.
We have music. Although you're not a jazz fan, but we have that interest in the blues.
That's right. Meaning
that I'm a harmonica player and you're a really nice guitar player, singer. Yeah. So we can communicate like
that. Yeah, and we both saw, I think you saw Sonny Terry, didn't you, and Brownie McGee?
I've seen some of those early people, on. I can't remember. Well, John Lee Hooker and all those people.
In the Fairfield Blues Festival. Yeah, I saw them, and I was quite young, and they left a big mark.
Oh, yeah. When you were at school, I remember you playing the guitar.
Yeah.
And you were one of the few boys at the school who played the guitar.
Yeah.
It's hard to think.
I suppose I was,
And I was playing the harmonica at
That's
school.
Right, which is... We didn't get any qualifications, but we played the blues, which I think that leads us into your second choice, really, which is, how do you pronounce this?
Gatto Barbieri.
It's an Argentinian player.
He is. Unfortunately, Gatto Barbieri is no longer with us. I've chosen all saxophone players today.
Yeah.
But this guy, he's Argentinian. He's a very Latin-based player. Beautiful tenor saxophone player. What a wonderful, wonderful sound he had. Great music he made. This was from one of his big albums, and it's called Straight Into the Sunrise.
Here we are then. I look forward to hearing this. Thank you. Okay, well, there we had... What do we have there, Richard?
Gatto Barbieri. And gatto means the cat.
Right. That was a lovely piece of music. Now, what I'd like to focus on now, you, as well as being a musician, you actually used your experience, as, you know, I have done in addiction and a lot of other people do, in all aspects of life, but you've used your life experience in working in mental health. Would you like to say a few words about that?
Yeah. Well, when I had gone back to work in my job, which is advertising, I decided to volunteer with Mind in Croydon to try and, partly to put something back, but also it was something I felt I could do. So that was as a volunteer. Then I went and worked in advertising for 15 years, up until 2000, I think, where I'd finished with my job. I'd fallen out with the guy I worked for, so I was completely out of the job because the job had just gone over to Apple Macs computers and I hadn't learned that skill. So, but I did know something about mental health and I had kept in touch with the project that I volunteered at East Croydon for Mind in Croydon, a mental health charity, a place called the Fairfield Club.
Yeah.
And the manager there phoned me one day and said, can you do, if you're interested, there's 3 months work here. Someone's gone on maternity leave. So I did. I went ahead and did that. That turned into a full-time job. I was a project worker there, and that lasted for 10 years. So it's basically, I didn't have any qualifications, but that, I suppose what I have is experience of having an understanding of the people that went there. It was a social club. So they were all mental health service users. And I felt very comfortable talking to them, trying to be positive with them. And and it was a job that I enjoyed. It included things like driving a minibus, cooking meals, all the rest of it.
There's another quite synchronistic thing here as well, because I volunteered at Mind. I don't know if you told me about it. You may have well done, told me about the Fairfield Club in Croydon, but I started doing some time there as a volunteer, and the project manager at the time, Mike, suggested that I might look for a job at Barnardo's, because that's what he did. And I did, and I got a job at Barnardo's, which lasted 11 years, 13 years, sorry. And as a result of that, I qualified as a social worker. So in a way, that the Fairfield Club for both of us was it was the beginning of my career, if you like, in social work.
And,
music, I sometimes took my guitar in, and played there. I think you did occasionally.
I did come to Barnardo's, yeah. I remember coming to that in Tennyson Road. I do remember that.
Yeah.
And
did you play at the Fairfield Club at all?
I would have done at different times. And I was in the pantomime because I was Widow Twankey. In all right. And I was quite involved in it. It was quite an interesting job. And they had some resources, I suppose, to finance things. We went. I'd drive the minibus to France on the day.
Oh yeah,
and very enjoyable. You know, I did tend to let the clients, or they weren't called clients, the club members.
Yeah,
I didn't really. When we went away, I let them. I did bring food on the bus and things like that. I wasn't, and that's in a way, that's what they liked about me, I suppose, that I wasn't really rigid, you know.
Like, yes, yeah.
So it worked well.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and then, I mean, you have a son, a great young man called Miles, don't you?
Miles Sutton.
Sutton. How old's Miles
now? He's 26. She's got a degree in jazz at Middlesex. First, he got a first in Middlesex University, and he teaches in, he lives in Hampstead. He teaches in Camden for Camden Music Services, and he does gigs with us. He's a real, he's a jazz head, you know.
He is, isn't he? Chip off the old block.
It's not my fault. I've got He did that off his own bat.
Yeah. So. And it's funny, really, because I, before coming here today to interview Richard, I popped in to see my youngest daughter, Harriet, who actually is expecting a baby, but anyway. And she is the same age as Miles. And I mentioned that I was coming round to see Richard, and she said, "Oh, how's Miles?" And, you know, so we've really, you know.
We've certainly known each other for a number of years.
Yeah.
And we've watched each other's children grow up, if you like.
That's right. That's right.
Because when they would have first met the children, they would have been 8 years old, probably.
They were, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I remember you had a little dog then, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, dogs don't live forever. They don't live forever.
They don't. Richard, what would you say, like any recovery, you know, is new horizons, uncovering new things about yourself? How would you say things have really changed in the last 40 years?
Well, I'm very grateful for being okay, being well. I mean, when you're in a state, in a kind of desperate state, you don't imagine there's ever going to be a better place for you. You think that's for life. You think your life is over.
Mm.
So the fact that I've been given a second chance, and I'm very, it's a miraculous thing for me. And I believe in miracles, which I wouldn't have done.
Yeah.
I'm not a religious person particularly, but I'm just very grateful for having my life back.
Mm.
And that, in a way, that puts you, when you're in recovery and you've got over your problems and you can just deal with your life, you're in a better place than you would have been if you'd never gone through it.
That's right.
Because you have a kind of optimism about you. You have that you can depend on. It's not going to be threatened, you know. So, yeah. So, you know, you still have difficult times, but you feel like you want to do something to help other people, perhaps. Sure. Yeah. Out of appreciation for your own life, you know. So, that's the way I see it. I mean,
that's right. Yeah.
I'm usually pretty upbeat and want to be a force for good, if you like, in a small way. And for me, I thought, well, how can I do this?
Mm.
And it's probably through music, I imagine.
Sure. Well, you are a force for good, most definitely. And linking that up with music, I must mention that you're quite iconic around these parts in South London, because you've been busking since 1980-ish?
Yeah.
On the streets of Croydon, Sutton,
Kingston, Charing Cross Road,
Bromley. You'll see Richard. He's playing a sax with some backing tracks. Yeah, I mean, he's just been known as Richard the Busker. And, you know, it's always good when I do go to Croydon and I hear those dulcet tones of his sax. And I'm like, Richard's there. We'll have a chat. And so that's been a big part of your life, isn't it, busking?
It has. It definitely is.
Meeting people.
Yeah, I mean, even when I was working, I was still busking.
Yeah.
It definitely is. I mean, you get... It's been a source of work, apart from anything else. A lot of people ask you to play at their weddings and garden parties.
That's right.
But also, you get people come to you, and some people walk past with their fingers in their ears. You can't please everyone.
Mm.
But other people, I remember playing in a Whitgift Centre for, and this woman was standing there and she started crying.
Oh,
and she said, "You've moved me.
Yes,
and it was something. I don't know what had happened to her. She'd lost someone. I think I was playing a tune. I tell you what I was playing. I was playing Saving All My Love for You.
All right.
By Whitney Houston.
Yes.
And if you feel you can do that for someone, obviously, I don't want everyone walking past me crying.
Not all the time, no.
But you think you must be doing something. You think that's worth doing. You know." And the money as well. And you obviously have made money from it.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, that's right. And
also it gets your music together. You know, you can learn, you can play tunes several times until you're happy with them. And then when you come to do a gig somewhere, you're ready for the gig. So it's been a good thing.
Mm.
And I met some wonderful people.
Yeah.
Charing Cross Road, all the tourists are up there.
Yeah.
And they can be really nice people. And all sorts of people will come and talk to you. I met Norman Wisdom. I had a chat with Norman Wisdom in Kingston once.
Oh, really? Yeah.
He went skipping off down the road.
Yeah, he was quite a remarkable man. Another man who'd had a really tough beginning.
Yeah. Huge. Definitely. He'd been living on the street.
Yeah, with his little brother, because his father was abusive and aggressive, and they had to leave and live on the streets.
Yeah, extraordinary man.
But turned it round, you know, and amazed.
And played the saxophone, apparently.
And played the sax, yeah. And again, recovery, you know. Wow, that's, yeah. Well, look, this has been a lovely interview for me, you know, very, very subjective, obviously, because I've known you so long and I've seen.
The great thing is that we are both in a good state of, we're in a state of well-being.
We are today.
We can't guarantee our physical health, but we can look after our.
That's right. I'd like to, all those years back, you went into Allingham Park. I want to give this man a mention because your consultant was a man called Dr. J.J. Gayford. And when I went into Pinnell House in the grounds of that hospital, my consultant was also J.J. Gayford. And he was a remarkable man and is a remarkable man. I met him a few years ago and I went down. He's an Anglican priest now. So he's still giving out to people, still helping others, you know. Well, look, Richard, what a great way to end, really, by playing a piece of music. And probably, well, I don't know, John Coltrane must be one of the greatest.
He's a giant. He was a giant. I mean, the music, no one's taken it any further than John Coltrane.
Really? No, no.
Beautiful player, but a very soulful player. This is a tune that was from his slightly earlier period, probably 1960, and it's a ballad. And his entrance to this song is just kind of stands me in my tracks. I just have to, I listened to this when I was 17, I'm still listening to it today. Mm. It's a tune from the album Soul Train, and it's called I Want to Talk About You. Thank you.
pleasure, Richard, to spend a bit of time with you, and I hope our listeners have got a lot from this session. So thanks again. Have a great new year.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to speak. It's very nice to be able
and,
to
And what can I say? Keep on keeping on.
Here's the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a fellowship for anyone who has a drinking problem. The number is 0800 917 7650. That's 0800 917 7650. The number of Narcotics Anonymous. This is a fellowship for anyone who has a drug problem. That's from 10 a.m. till midnight. The number is 0300 999 1212. 0300 999 1212. And finally, Al-Anon, which is a fellowship to support family and friends of the alcoholic. It's from 10 a.m. till 10 p.m. The number is 0207 403 0888. That's 0207 403 0888.